expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of Natural Bridges Media or KSQD's staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
Hello. My name is Jill Cody, and welcome to Be Bold America. Be Bold America is a live biweekly talk show for those who are motivated to step out with the bold actions necessary to begin reuniting this country and saving our democracy. Be Bold America is for those who want to understand the unique challenges ahead and who are curious to learn what they can keep doing, stop doing, and start doing to save our democratic republic. Our future depends on it. Our program today is Surviving Political Tribalism. When people feel aggrieved or threatened, they retreat into their political tribes, thinking and repeating what the tribe tells you to think and say may become more important than facts and the truth. With political tribalism, seeking truth has become optional, even frowned upon. What political factions do when feeling threatened is they close ranks and become even more defensive, so much so that members may no longer be capable of self-reflection and never realize the bias they interject into their daily lives. The tragic reality is that just about every individual and our group in America today feels threatened, bullied, and on the losing end of life in some manner, whether true or not. It is up to every individual to mentally fight that manipulation. We have big things to do. My in-studio guest today is our own Catherine Bell. Catherine is host of the Dream Journal, airing Saturdays from 10 to 11 a.m. right here on KSQD. Read about her work at experientialdreamwork.com. Catherine had a political awakening in 2016 and attended the Women's March in Washington, D.C. in 2017. She is now active in the organizations Indivisible and Swing Left and is especially interested in improving our healthcare system. On the matter of political tribalism, she has had extensive training in nonviolent communication and the personal experience of having not one, but two siblings who support Donald Trump. Our bold and special call-in guest today is Dr. Dan Stalder. Dan is a professor of psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. He received awards for his teaching and research. He is the author of The Power of Context, How to Manage Our Bias and Improve Our Understanding of Others. He's written articles about political tribalism, hypocrisy, bias, and individual differences. And he's been interviewed by outlets such as The Atlantic, The Verge, and NPR. Dan has had several articles published in Psychology Today, such as Do Democrats and Republicans Truly Misunderstand Each Other? And Tribalism in Politics. We've been looking forward to speaking with you. Thank you for joining us today, Dan.
Hello, thank you for having me.
To kick things off, in your Tribalism in Politics, you told a story about a valedictorian speech, and I thought you might share it with us and then explain what political tribalism is.
Sure. So there was a valedictorian, I guess it was about a year and a half ago now, and it was in Kentucky, and the valedictorian was giving a speech, and at some point in the speech, he gave an inspirational quote. And he attributed that quote to Donald Trump, and the crowd cheered. And then the valedictorian said, oh, wait a minute, actually it was Barack Obama who said that. And the crowd, of course, stopped cheering, and some of them even started groaning. And the issue is, how could the power of the quote have changed just because who said it changed? And the answer, among many answers, one of the answers is political tribalism, because the audience presumably supported Donald Trump and they didn't support Barack Obama.
And so what is political tribalism?
So, like you were saying, it's going along with your group, going along with your group leader, even if it's not common sense, even if it goes against facts. even if it goes against your own personal values that you were publicly espousing the week before. It's also about attacking your critics, that is, attacking the critics of your group, attacking the critics of your leader. But beyond that, I also wanted to say how it is also a change in how we think. If you are behaving in a tribalistic way, your brain starts to shift down into more simplistic thinking. This includes black and white thinking, all or nothing thinking, you're with us or against us. It also includes something called the ad hominem fallacy, where you will discount an argument, you will discount a proposal, you will argue against a proposal, not on the proposal's merits, not on the substance of the proposal, but because of characteristics of those who proposed the proposal. And so if the proposal comes from the other side, if it comes from the political group that you are not part of, some of us discount that proposal out of hand. That's called the ad hominem fallacy, among other things. So it's a different way of thinking. It's a simplified way of thinking in addition to our behaviors of just going along.
Well, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't ask about the upcoming Senate impeachment trial, because it seems to me the pinnacle of political tribalism is publicly saying before an impeachment trial, I mean, it seems an impeachment trial is a pinnacle of democracy. It hasn't been done just three times. And that you say before the trial even starts, such as Mitch McConnell and Lindsey Graham said, that they already were not impartial jurors. And yet, last week, they just took an oath declaring to all of us that they would be impartial. So what are your thoughts on what's coming up next week?
Yeah, that's a pretty extreme example of many things, including hypocrisy, including the extremity that, you know, political tribalism is showing itself. Specifically, so I'm a social psychologist, and I've done research and a lot of reading on something called cognitive dissonance theory. Cognitive dissonance is a discomfort from inconsistency. It's a feeling of hypocrisy. And despite the frequency with which some politicians behave in hypocritical ways, I speculate that they still feel dissonance, that they still feel some discomfort at having said one thing and then say something else, or having said one thing and then behaved in a different way. And so I don't imagine I'll be able to talk about all of the components of cognitive dissonance theory right now, but there are established ways people reduce their dissonance once they get caught. So I would say that McConnell and Lindsey Graham and others who have publicly said they're not going to be impartial, and now they've taken the oath that says they're going to be impartial, I'm speculating that they're feeling dissonance, and then there are research-based ways to reduce that dissonance. And I don't think we can ever get into the minds of these particular individuals, but one of the ways in general people reduce their dissonance is through something called external justification, also known as rationalization, that I did what I had to do because it's necessary for me to keep my job. Or they might be saying to themselves, it's necessary for the betterment of the country. We need to keep a Republican in the presidency, and that's why we're doing it, and that's called external justification. Even if it's true, even if they think it's true, it's still one of the ways to reduce dissonance.
I wonder if one of the ways that we all reduce dissonance in our mind is by moving into our lower brain. You mentioned earlier that that people move into their lower brain when they are under the sway of political tribalism, and that takes us out of our logical brain. And so maybe we don't sense the dissonance as profoundly or as overtly, because we're in a lower state of mind. So, you know, when we get to the point of like calling names and making judgments about others, as opposed to really considering the issues and really talking rationally about the topic, then it puts us in the lower state of mind.
Yes, I would agree. In general, dissonance affects us more when we're aware of it, when we are cognizant of the fact that we did say one thing and then do something else. But I would speculate that even if we're in our lower brain, even if we're thinking simplistically, that would be the means through which we carry out some of these modes of distance reduction. Some of these modes of distance reduction work better when we are thinking more simplistically.
Mm-hmm.
For example, another way to reduce distance is to engage in self-affirmations. And so technically, Mitch McConnell could say to himself, okay, yeah, I'm a big hypocrite, but I'm a good politician in other ways, or I'm a good parent, or I'm a good lawyer, or he can find ways to balance it out. And that's not very rational. That's not really relevant, but it is one of the ways we reduce our distance. Another common way to reduce distance is through something called social comparison, where we might say to ourselves, everyone in Washington has to lie, or everyone in Washington has to take oaths that they don't really mean. That's part of being a politician. And whether or not that's true, it is a social comparison way to reduce distance. And I'm suggesting, in response to what you're saying, I'm suggesting that it's easier to engage in these less rational modes of distance reduction if you have shifted down a little bit.
Yeah, and I think there's a certain amount of like shifting down that I think that President Trump is famous for, that in his rallies where they're very emotional and they really are getting people to respond on a very emotional level rather than really thinking about what they are doing.
Yeah, although emotion and rationality do not have to be distinct, they often do operate separately in these examples, like at rallies, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So is an example of lack of cognitive distance, or maybe it's something else, because I was very shocked when I heard several months ago Attorney General William Barr, who was being interviewed about what he was doing that actually supported Donald Trump and not the country, and it was just so obvious that he's part of the Trump political tribe, that when he was asked if he was concerned about his legacy, he said, why should I care? I'd be dead.
So if we were to suppose that he meant exactly what he said,
mm-hmm.
then one possibility is that he didn't feel any distance about it.
Mm-hmm.
But based on my research and based on all the reading that I've done, I think a more likely explanation is that he was feeling distance, but he reduced it with that statement, with that rationalization.
So he could live with his cognitive dissonance better because of he made that statement publicly.
Yes, assuming he believed that statement and making it publicly, yes. We also always have to contend with the possibility that what people say when they're interviewed or on the news or on blogs, they don't necessarily mean it. It's just for self-presentation, and they might be reducing their dissonance in some private way that we have no knowledge of.
You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM, many voices, one station. Listen worldwide online at ksqd.org. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
KSQD thanks Attorney Ned Hearn for supporting this program. Ned Hearn specializes in intellectual property and business law with a focus on entertainment, internet, and computer software business and their convergence, intersecting content, media, and technology in the digital environment. More info at www.internetmedialaw.com. Thank you, Ned Hearn, for supporting KSQD 90.7 FM.
We're back with our guest, Catherine Bell, who is our own KSQD Dream Journal host and a community activist with Santa Cruz Indivisible and Swing Left. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Dan Stalder from the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. His expertise is on bias, individual differences, and cognitive dissonance theory. And you may find him at the Psychology Today website. Dan, what is the role of lies in cognitive dissonance?
Lies? You mean telling lies?
Yes.
So, I suppose it would fall under self-presentation, like I was saying a few minutes ago before the break. So you can say whatever you need to feel better in terms of what people think about you. But maybe the more interesting answer to your question is when we lie to ourselves, mm-hmm. but maybe that's not what you mean.
Well, and also the role of lies play in creating bias, too.
Sure. So, yeah, if you take typical politician who might lie about something, and I'm not saying all politicians lie, but if we take an example where a politician lies, presumably the politician thinks of himself or herself as a decent person, as an honest person, as a stand-up person. So if we assume politicians think that about themselves and yet they lie, that should create dissonance, like we were talking about a little earlier. And then these multiple modes of dissonance reduction would possibly kick in. And so, I'm sorry, what exactly was your question again about lies?
Just the role of lies in your expertise, you know, in creating bias. And, you know, it just seems that it's so hard to find the truth and facts because there's people, I call it anti-character. Mm-hmm. You know, when we think of character, we're honest, we have integrity, we value the truth, we're trustworthy. And many people are, you know that that's what they should be doing. And don't do it because their tribe, their political tribe is more important. So the lies seem to be very prevalent in our society right now and not seeking truth.
Well, in terms of social psychology research from over the last several decades, human beings have always lied regularly. Every person, I cannot say every person, but most people lie at least a little. Some people lie regularly. Sometimes it's about little stuff. Sometimes it's about really big stuff. And I would say if you're a political leader and you're on TV and you're representing your party, okay, a lie in that context would be a big thing. And yeah, I would agree that tribalism breeds more lying because what matters most or almost most in tribalism is supporting your group or supporting your group leader. And sometimes that means that you have to tell lies or that you have to explain facts in a way that are less detrimental to the image of your group leader. So yeah, lying, I guess, could be one of the defining features of tribalism when you talk about politicians who have to talk and have to give interviews and such.
Well, one of the examples that Jill and I were talking about earlier is that when Trump goes on the in the public and says that he's going to keep pre-existing conditions for healthcare and he's going to improve our healthcare, and yet at the same time, his administration is working to totally take down the Affordable Care Act. And there's a real contrast between the public things that he's saying and what he's actually working to do.
Sure. And I would guess, I mean, it's been established that Donald Trump lies more than other presidents have, maybe a lot more. But I think it's also fair to say that all presidents have lied in some respects. And then the public has to decide whether they believe the president or not. And well, I think, go ahead.
Oh, I just was thinking of George Costanza on the Seinfeld show. And he says, you know, it's not a lie if you believe it. So, like, you know, I think there's a lot of the things that Trump says that he probably believes. He thinks they're true because that's what he thinks, you know, he thought it, so it must be true. So there's like, yeah. He wouldn't say it's a lie because it's true.
So if we define a lie as inconsistent with facts, mm-hmm. then that might lead this conversation in a particular way. But if we define a lie as you're saying something that you personally know is not true, that does complicate the analysis or the interpretation of Donald Trump and a lot of what he says, because I agree, we can't get into his mind. I mean, we can't get into anyone's mind, but Donald Trump in particular, though many have tried in their books and their blogs, you know, we can't be 100% sure what he really believes. And so it's certainly plausible that when he says things that are untrue, that he himself might not see them as untrue, mm-hmm. truly, even though in some cases it's ludicrous, and maybe in other gray areas it's a little bit harder to be sure about.
So, Dan, one of your articles was titled, Do Democrats and Republicans Truly Misunderstand Each Other? Do they?
The answer is yes.
Tell us more.
Yeah, it's the point, the reason I wanted to write that article is because even though we do misunderstand each other, it's been, based on the research that I'm aware of, including just in the last year or two, the statement that Democrats and Republicans misunderstand each other is an overstatement. It's a little bit blown out of proportion. So yes, we misunderstand each other, but not as much as most of us might think. For example, Democrats think 50% of Republicans acknowledge racism, and actually 80% of Republicans say, yeah, racism is still a problem. in this country. So that sounds like it's a difference. But it depends on how you define racism. And so there was an author or a researcher who came out and said, actually, Republicans think that racism is a bigger problem for white people, that white people experience greater racism than black people. And now that you've redefined racism like that, then there's not as much of a misunderstanding anymore. Then Democrats probably do accurately understand how much Republicans acknowledge racism against people of color. It's just that in the question asking about racism, Republicans were thinking about racism against whites and not just against people of color.
Oh,
but I think a more interesting, in terms of my article, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
In terms of my article, what was more interesting to me was the research that shows that as much as Republicans may misunderstand Democrats and vice versa, Democrats even misunderstand their own group, and Republicans even misunderstand their own group. Two examples. Republicans think about a third of Democrats are atheist, when actually less than 10% of Democrats are atheist. And you might say to yourself, whoa, you know, Republicans are really going with the stereotype here because so few Democrats are atheist. So those numbers were that Republicans think a third of Democrats are atheist, less than 10% of them actually are. But when Democrats are asked themselves, what percent of Democrats do you think are atheist? Democrats themselves think it's 25%. So even Democrats themselves are overestimating how many Democrats are atheist. And my other example has to do with income. There's a stereotype about Republicans that they make more money, and Democrats think about 44% of Republicans make more than $250,000 a year. The actual statistics are less than 5%. Less than 5% of Republicans make that much money. And so Democrats are really going with the stereotype here. However, Republicans think 33% of Republicans make that much money. My point is that when you're misunderstanding the other side, that's bad. When you're going with the stereotype of the other side, that's bad. But if you're stereotyping your own group almost as much, that might take some of the sting out of the statement that Democrats and Republicans misunderstand each other.
It says how powerful stereotypes are.
Yes, that is another moral to this story, yes.
Mm. So you also had an article on Psychology Today, Out of Context Biases All Have One Solution. And I found that, you were talking about how quotes are taken out of context and video clips and the fundamental attribution error, which I'd like you to explain.
Sure.
And you say that to combat these biases is not to investigate the original source or fact-checking sites. What do you suggest instead?
So the fundamental attribution error, I can define that first?
Yes, of course.
So when we try to explain other people's behaviors, and in the context of the show today, when we try to explain another group's behaviors, we tend to underestimate the power of the context. We tend to underestimate the situational factors that might be driving the behavior, and we tend to overestimate character or character traits or intentions. And so if we're trying to explain why Republicans behave a particular way and we just say to themselves, well, they're greedy or they have negative intentions toward this group of people, that could be an example of a fundamental attribution error because there might be situational factors that we are underestimating. So that's the fundamental attribution error, that we tend to jump to traits and characteristics and intentions and underestimate or underinvestigate the possible contextual factors or situational factors. So that's the FAE, that's the fundamental attribution error. And when we are trying to understand another group, the provocative news blurbs, the provocative tweets, maybe it's fake news, maybe it's just a misleading statement that somebody tweeted, that feeds into the FAE. If it's a negative statement about the other side, that'll feed into our biases that we have, that it's something about the character, it's something about the intentions of the other side. And yeah, my proposed one solution is to slow down, meaning don't believe everything you read right away. And the phrase don't believe everything you read might kind of be obvious, but sometimes with social media, we will believe something and retweet it and share it really quickly without thinking. without checking it, without going to the fact-checking sites. So what I actually said in my article is that it would be great if social media users did fact-check tweets and blurbs before they shared them, but I didn't think that was really realistic, and so what I secondarily suggested was that we at least pause in our belief, we at least pause before we share, before we retweet, so that at a minimum, the thing about pausing, a lot of things can happen if you pause. If you pause in your belief, if you don't believe it right away, if you wait to retweet it, one of the things that could happen is new information might come to light and then you might end up not believing it. But another thing that could happen as a minimum is that those neurotransmitters that underlie your anger or underlie your disgust, those neurotransmitters can return to baseline, and then you might be able to logically assess the information, whereas before maybe you were less able.
You know, one thing that gets me thinking also about this is, you know, I often think of us as the disunited states of America. And it may be my bias that I think Fox News has had a lot to do with that. For example, on January 15th, there was no coverage of what Lev Parnas was talking about and his documents on Fox News. But then they were saying that Democrats lowered the flag to half-mast in honor of the killing of Soleimani, which didn't happen. There were no flags lowered. How does things like that fit together? That gives me cognitive dissonance.
Yeah, I think there is a fair statement. There's a fair statement there to say there's cognitive dissonance here because we live in a country, we have free press, and yet we have cable news shows or bloggers or radio show hosts who will speak things that are not true, and they will ignore relevant news. That's what you're saying. So, yeah, unfortunately, I don't want to be too philosophical here because I'm not a philosopher or a political scientist, but with free press comes the possibility that we have shows like Fox News and MSNBC. I don't know if MSNBC is as biased as Fox News is. I don't want to do a false equivalency here, but I'm just saying that there are shows on both sides that will give a relatively skewed picture of reality. And in the case of Fox News, yeah, I think researchers have already documented what you're saying about Fox News. It's a regular thing with them. And so the risk here is that if you mostly watch Fox News, which not all Republicans, but a lot of Republicans get most or all of their news from Fox News, and that's the danger, right? Because if you're trusting one news source and they have a skewed perception of a skewed reporting of the news, then you'll have a skewed perception of where you live, and that could contribute to what you were saying about us not being that united.
Right. Well, I was exercising one day, and there's this bank of TV stations, TVs with stations, and Fox News is always on one or two of them. And one day I was seeing a news banner underneath, and the banner said, this was on Fox News station, fake news versus Fox News. And I thought, how subtle that is to just make everything else that isn't Fox fake. And then when I was doing my research with for my book, America Abandoned, I learned that there hadn't been one but six studies to replicate this, that people that watch Fox News aren't misinformed, but they're malinformed. They believe wrong things. That, I guess, adds to the cognitive dissonance or bias in the country as well, right?
Yeah, well, definitely it adds to the bias. The dissonance that I alluded to had to do with, you know, we live in a country where people are smart and people are rational and the free press does a good job. But then we have examples like you're alluding to where the press is not doing a good job. And so if anyone becomes too aware of that, then yeah, they might feel some dissonance about where they live.
Or their job isn't what we think it is. Their job or purpose or agenda is something very different than what we're expecting it to be. You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Jill Cody, and we're speaking with Dan Stalder, professor at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater, who has the Bias Fundamentals blog on the Psychology Today website. And we're speaking with Catherine Bell, host of the Dream Journal on Saturdays from 10 to 11, right here on KSQD. Find her at experientialdreamwork.com. Also, tune in to KSQD Mondays at 6 o'clock for Climate One, produced by the Commonwealth Club. Climate One is a forum for candid discussion among climate scientists, policymakers, activists, and concerned citizens with a focus on energy, the economy, and the environment. Climate One airs Monday, 6 p.m., right after Talk of the Bay, here on KSQD 90.7 FM. So back to our guests, our bold and inspiring guests. Now, Dan, do you have views on how political tribalism is killing our democracy, or it's not killing our democracy? I don't want to make too leading a question there.
So like I said, I'm not a political scientist, mm-hmm. and so maybe I'll reserve judgment a little bit on the big question you're asking.
Good, okay.
I obviously, the tribalism we're talking about and the consequences of the tribalism that we're talking about are counter to the democracy that, you know, the founders had in mind and counter to the democracy that most politicians say that they want. So, you know, the lean of your question is valid, but I'll go out on a limb, not being a political scientist or a historian, I'll go out on a limb and say, you know, democracy in general and our democracy is strong enough that we'll survive this. We have to wait it out and not be passive, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, some of us may want to be passive, and I'm not going to second-guess those individuals' choices because I don't know what their lives are. But for those of us who don't want to be passive, I, of course, encourage you not to be passive and do what you think you need to do to help our democracy, because tribalism and other things that have been going on are counter-democratic. But I'm optimistic that it will be okay eventually. That's my optimism, my untrained optimism.
Oh, I like that. Go ahead, Catherine.
One of the things that the way that I want to support our democracy is by maintaining relationships. And that this is extremely important that we not isolate ourselves in our bubbles. And one of the places that we often get exposed to a wide variety of views is in our own family. Because with our friends, we tend to sort ourselves into groups that think alike. But when we have families, like in my case, I have two siblings that are very conservative. And yet I've really made it a commitment to stay in relationship with them. Excuse me. And it's really an art of how to find common ground. And I find that this is a really powerful thing to keep stepping back. And you talked about attribution error. Like an example would be to think that your beliefs are, like my own personal beliefs are held because of rationally well thought out ideas, and other people are just swayed by demagogues, you know. So that's a way of thinking that my way is more valuable than their way. And so I want to be aware of that when I'm speaking to my siblings and give them the benefit of the doubt that they are thinking people, and they made choices based on what they think is best. And so you should try to find some kind of common ground. And sometimes it just comes down to this is really troubling time right now, isn't it? And that's something that we can all agree on. And that's like a good place to start.
Absolutely. And a lot of social psychologists who have devoted their time to conflict resolution would agree with you about keeping relationships. And you're giving benefit of doubt to these individuals mm-hmm. on the other political side. And that's exactly what my book suggests. And that's exactly what I'm trying to suggest in some of what I'm saying today, that if we slow down our thinking, if we try to step back, if we try to give benefit of doubt to the other side, and then we have to cross our fingers and hope that the other side is giving benefit of doubt to us
yep.
because if they're not doing that, so this is one of the practical realities, Jill, in terms of some of what I know that you do. One of the practical realities is that if we on one side are trying to give benefit of doubt and those on the other side are not giving benefit of doubt, that could be a way to lose elections, hypothetically, in the short term. And so there's some degree of hope that we have that they're, you know, trying to meet us halfway. On the other hand, there is no reason that we cannot give benefit of doubt and still fight really hard for our candidate to win.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's possible we can do both. And what I like about doing both is that then the candidates that you want to win may still win, but then you're also not putting yourself at risk of demonizing the other side. You're not putting yourself as at great risk. You're not putting yourself to the same degree of risk of demonizing the other side, of seeing them in a biased way. And so if there are opportunities, Catherine, you and your brothers you're talking about, or your siblings rather?
A brother and a sister.
Brother and sister. So if you have opportunities to find common ground, or if you have opportunities to agree on something politically by not demonizing them for years, by not making biased pronouncements about them, you know, for the years of your relationships with them, then if an opportunity does present itself later, you and they will be able to take advantage of that better.
Right.
Well, it does remind me of I do feel badly when I see people wearing T-shirts that say "Better Russian than Democrat."
Ooh.
You know, and I don't ever see a T-shirt that says "Better Republican than Russian," a Russian Republican. I feel like, and maybe this is my own bias again, that Democrats are demonized a lot when. A lot more. I just don't see T-shirts out there and bumper stickers with anti-Republican themes so much. Am I wrong, Catherine? You see?
You know, it's so tricky because of that darn attribution error.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that we may think we have lofty ideals and we're respectful, but the conservatives also think they have lofty mm-hmm. ideas and they're mm-hmm. respectful. So, mm-hmm. I just have to take the high road in that regard, and say that no matter what, I'm gonna just fight clean, because partly for my own self respect, because I can't really like weigh it that way. I think that way maddens lies. I don't mm-hmm. think that's a helpful direction to go. That I have to fight the fight that I want to feel good about.
Well, I think also this is a good time for me to point out, and I think I sent you this, Dan, is that one of our leading Native American friends here, Stan Rushworth, he's a professor at Cabrillo College, you know, he was pointing out that sometimes it bothers him when we talk about tribalism and not saying political tribalism or political factions, because from the Native American standpoint, a tribe is a good thing. It's representing community and good fellowship, and they celebrate intertribal connection, and they have intertribal dances. So I wanted to at least point out that we are probably helping to demonize the word tribalism mm-hmm. here if we don't put a caveat before it, like political tribalism, or start using the word factions. What are your thoughts, Dan?
Yeah, labels can hurt. Labels can offend some people, and I regret that there are individuals who are offended by the use of the word tribalism. One of many issues here is that if the news is talking about tribalism, well, then it makes more sense as a news organization or as a radio show to just use the word that people recognize. But then we could throw this caveat in there, which you just did, that there are some Americans, there are some people here who, you know, wish that word was not used. And I'd be completely fine using the word factionalism, you know, if it would be as understood, if it would be as understandable to people when we talk about it. I think that when I teach my social psychology courses, I tell students a label is a label, and when you're reading a research article, just find the operational definition. The operational definition is how the writer, how the researcher intends the word, how the writer means what the writer means. But outside the research lab, outside the classroom, I do acknowledge that some people can get offended by some words. But even if we talk about tribalism in the context that we're talking about it, with all its negative consequences, we can certainly acknowledge all the benefits from tribalism. You mentioned a few in terms of the sense of community.
Community. Mm-hmm.
Tribalism also helps to win elections, in my opinion, like I was alluding to a little bit earlier.
Right.
Tribalism also makes our feelings of belonging rise. We feel more like we belong, which is part of what you were saying, but it's also good for our egos. It makes us feel more certain. One of the anxieties that people have in life is about those things that we cannot know. And when you join a group and when you follow your leader, that provides answers, that provides certainty where we did not have it before. And so whether consciously or unconsciously, being part of a group, being a loyal member of a group, provides what researchers call closure. It's not the closure when you lose a loved one to death, but it's a closure, a psychological closure, that you can feel more certain that your beliefs are right. You can feel more certain about your view of the world, and that's psychologically beneficial. Mm-hmm. So absolutely, tribalism can have pros and cons, even if the nature of the show thus far, you know, 40 minutes in, that we're mostly talking about the negative consequences.
Right. I just thought it would be good to point out that there can be those positive ones, mm-hmm. and that in our culture now, we're probably divided a lot more with social media, and I'm thinking that the good side of tribe is finding a home with a group, and that mm-hmm. is community, but feeling like you have a place in America.
Well, and there is something about being human and that we really operate mostly on some kind of autopilot that there's like, even literally driving, that there's so many operations that go on below the level of consciousness that's really necessary for us to move forward. And we can function in society without needing to know precisely, you know, how a toilet works or how a zipper works. But we know that somebody knows. And so politically, too, I think we kind of find a certain, I'm going to say zeitgeist, I'm not sure if that's exact correct use of that word, but they want to find a group that resonates with who we are. And then we don't need to examine every little thing about that. But then we kind of subscribe to the whole thing. And that is a very useful thing about being human. But it does have a danger that there are things that might get into the list of the check marks that we maybe really don't agree with if we were to look at it more closely.
Well, does it seem like it's easier being a human being to fall into a tribe? Dan, help me with this. I don't think democracy comes naturally. A democracy has to be built and nurtured and cared for, and people discuss and compromise and debate. But it seems like for human creatures, falling into a tribe is more natural. So we have to kind of fight against that to be able to live in a democracy. What are your thoughts on that, Dan?
Tribalism probably does have some evolutionary underpinnings. It probably does have some instinctual underpinnings, which I think you're alluding to.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of tribalism is also about what we learn as we grow up. As we grow up, we learn that going along with people in your group, and some groups we fall into, right? We're born into racial groups and certain family groups or neighborhoods or ethnic groups or religious groups. And so if you're born into this group, going along with this group has rewards attached to it. Doing what your parents tell you to do, agreeing with your pastor, going along with your buddies at school, I mean, there are rewards attached to that. And our brains, through operant conditioning and classical conditioning, that's one of the ways our brains learn. And so that's not so much that we have an instinct to be tribal, but we do have an instinct to do what has rewards attached to it. We do have an instinct to avoid punishment, because if we don't go along with our buddies and if we don't go along with our group, then we get punished. Politically especially, if you don't go along with your political group, Donald Trump or otherwise, there are punishments in terms of you getting criticized or you getting kicked out of the party or kicked off your committee. And that's an instinct to learn. That's not an instinct to be tribal.
Boy, that's a really big thought, because we do have an aversion to pain.
Exactly.
And they can, and families and peer groups and communities can really probably give you a lot of mental and emotional anguish if you don't toe the line, and so the rewards come in. So that's a whole nother discussion. I think that's a big one. But I guess it's important just being aware of how this operates in your own life. And you're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM, Many Voices, One Station. Listen worldwide online at ksqd.org. Following Be Bold America is Reflections on Buddhism. Join us at 6 o'clock right after this show for our monthly program, Reflections on Buddhism. This month, the Venerable Tenzin, a local Buddhist nun and teacher, discusses the three marks of existence, or universal truths. You hear existential Buddhist teachings on the nature of impermanence, and how to incorporate this understanding into your day-to-day life. Tune in for this thoughtful, uplifting, and practical conversation for the first half hour. And then in the second half hour, starting at 6:30, tune in to an interview with Matilda Rand, who talks with Barry Van Driel, who works at the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam as a consultant for the European Commission. Matilda will be talking to Barry about tolerance, education, and intercultural connections. That's right after this program from 6 to 7 on KSQD 90.7 FM, Many Voices, One Station. You're listening to Be Bold America, and if you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Dan Stalder, who has won a Letters in Sciences Excellence and Research Award and the 2019 Outstanding Research Award, both from the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater, and Catherine Bell, community activist with Santa Cruz Indivisible. I'm your host, Jill Cody. So, Dan, I have prepared you. The last quarter hour, I like to talk about what listeners can keep doing, stop doing, and start doing. Because we all say, well, what can I do? And I believe individuals can actually do a lot. And I was looking at your, I know it's on hiatus for your blog or your page on the Psychology Today website. But your Persons at Risk of Bias page had, I thought, quite a lot of interesting things that would fit in the keep, start, stop, like the Persons at Risk Anonymous, the four slogans and the pledges there, and the sharing about conformity and bias with fake news. So I wanted to talk about those as well as what you might have. What would you like to start with?
Well, I've had a lot of ideas here, and I tried to narrow them down.
I'm excited.
Yeah, the website that I run, the blog that I run, called PARBS Anonymous, P-A-R-B is the Person at Risk of Bias. I started that blog in 2014, and that blog is no longer actively growing. So
the information's still there, that the four slogans and the pledges, which I think were fascinating. Is that a .com or it's a WordPress?
It's a WordPress, yeah.
Yeah. So it's PARB Anonymous WordPress.com?
Basically.
Yeah.
I can't remember the exact address, but it is WordPress. If you type in PARBS Anonymous, you'll find it. And yeah, there are slogans and pledges there. The idea of the PARBS Anonymous website is to try to acknowledge that you might be biased. And I try really hard not to point a finger at anyone in particular. We're not necessarily mm-hmm. all biased.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know particular readers or particular visitors to the site, and so I let the reader decide if he or she thinks mm-hmm. they're biased. But I think we're all at risk of bias. That's the bottom line. Humans are not perfect. To err is human, and so I encourage us to be open to the possibility. And Catherine, you were saying that about yourself with your siblings. If you can just be open to that possibility, mm-hmm. that could potentially do wonders.
Yep.
So in terms of what we can keep doing, and I want to preface this by saying that your listeners and people at large, I don't know who you all are. And so some of you may already be doing these things. Some of you, like when I say what you should start doing, okay, well, some of you are already doing these things, so I don't want to make any assumptions about anyone in particular, but just in the spirit of this part of the show, I think we should keep learning. We should keep reading. We should keep listening. I mean, just listening to this show potentially can be helpful. If you learn more about bias, if you learn more about tribalism, if you learn about the logical fallacies that I've been alluding to, there's the either-or fallacy. You're either with us or against us. That's a logical fallacy, and if you learn about that, if you become aware that that's a fallacy, then maybe you might be more able to step back from it. And I think we can also keep being civil in our language. Language can affect your thinking, and I can give you a lot of examples for that, but the point is that civil language is not just about being polite and feeling good in the moment. Being civil in our language also affects our thoughts about the other side, and it affects their thoughts about us.
Well, one thing that came up for me when you were talking is my mother used to say when she bought lots of recipe books, mm-hmm. and she said, if I got one good recipe out of this book, it would be worth it. Mm-hmm. And I feel the same about discussions like this, that if you get one thing that sticks with you, it's going to stick with you for life. And the four slogans I thought were very helpful too. They were show me the data, just living, just okay, you're saying that, but where's the data? Where's the support for that? Explaining does not mean excusing. The only certainty in life is uncertainty. And there's no statute of limitations on getting upset at someone. What's the rush? Dan, can you explain more on your four slogans there?
Sure.
Yeah.
So show me the data is having basis for your statements, whether it's research basis or other facts at hand. What I'd like to spend time talking about is how explaining does not mean excusing, because sometimes when I talk about the fundamental attribution error, when I talk about how we can jump to conclusions about other people, and that maybe the Democrat who's saying stupid stuff or the Republican who's saying stupid stuff, we could identify some problems they're having in their life right now. Like maybe the politician who does something terrible is going through a divorce, or maybe their father just passed away, or who knows what. And none of that excuses the bad behavior. We can still get upset at the bad behavior. We can still try to stop the bad behavior. Explaining is not excusing. If we can better explain the bad behavior from a politician or from whomever, if we can better explain that behavior, then we're less likely to demonize the other side. We are more able to prevent future bad behaviors. There's a lot of good reason to explain bad behaviors, and it's just really important to have a conversation where no one gets upset at anybody. It's important in having a conversation that you don't equate explaining with excusing. We're not excusing bad behaviors. When we social psychologists talk about situational causes for bad behavior, we're not trying to excuse it, and that helps the conversation to be productive. And if you are upset at somebody, in many cases, if not most cases, you don't have to show that you're upset right away. This is part of slowing down. This is part of reserving judgment. You can be really angry, you can be really disgusted, but there's usually no harm in waiting to act on it. There's usually no harm in waiting to voice your disgust or to voice your anger. You can gather more information, wait for the neurotransmitters to return to baseline, and you can still get upset later. And these types of slogans potentially could make for more productive conversations with the other side.
So that last one seems to be the part of the slow down.
Yes.
Mantra, yes, and which would just help us on social media, keeping more civil if we would slow down and just
absolutely.
Wait.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm. My main slow down suggestion, and this is one of the stops in the keep, stop, start. Mm-hmm. The social media users who share and retweet really quickly, I was going to recommend that we stop doing that, that we take our time and process the information and maybe wait for some mainstream news sources to verify the information. Mainstream news is more balanced than most of us think, and so if we can wait for some mainstream news to verify it, then we can retweet it, then we can share it later. I think we should stop retweeting and sharing as quickly as we do.
Excellent advice. Well, and I think your pledges also fit into the start, because, like, for example, the first one you have, I pledge to be open to the possibility of my own biases, and that could be, you know, I'm going to start being open to the possibility of my own biases. Do you have other starts there too?
Yeah, I had several starts, and some of them are pretty simple. Not that they'll be easy to do, but they're pretty easy to state. Like sometimes we accuse someone of the other side of being willfully ignorant or willfully deceitful. And one of my suggestions is that we start deleting the word willfully.
Mm.
We can call someone ignorant, we can call someone deceitful, and without the word willfully, we're accomplishing several potential outcomes. We're not assuming intention, we're not assuming we can read their mind for their intention, and that might soften our perception of them. Not that we're going to start liking them, but it might make us less angry or less demonizing of them. So just remove the word willfully. We can also maybe, if we feel hate for the other side, I don't know how truly applicable that is to anyone on either side, but if we do feel hate for the other side, I would encourage us to redefine that hate of others as hate of their behavior.
Mm-hmm. Sort of when I told my son when he was little, I love you, but I don't like the things you just did.
Mm-hmm. Excellent example, right? And sometimes we might think of that as a word game. On the other hand, if we could really try to embrace that and really try to process what that means, that could be helpful. And I don't want to plug a particular politician, but Nancy Pelosi famously said that she doesn't hate Donald Trump, and that's the spirit of what I'm getting at here. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, in terms of my pledges, I pledge to interpret carefully any negative statements from emails, text messages, or tweets, and that fits right into that social media message that we were sharing earlier, that there are limits to how much you can understand from a tweet or from an email or from a text, and sometimes we will interpret it worse than it was actually meant.
Well, and it also, there's a, I do have on my... on the KSQD website, a paper that I wrote or a blog I wrote called Living in the Red, Living in the Black. And living in the red is living with all those negative emotions and the anger and the hatred and not being trustworthy and all those negative statements that you talk about. If it presses that button, living in the black would be the opposite of that, living with the good things that are constructive and compelling. But negative statements are destructive and repelling. And so if you find an email or a text or a tweet to push that button that repels you, or it's destructive in somehow, or it's hurting somebody else, that's usually a good moment to realize that you might want to slow down, as we've talked about.
Right, slow down. It's possible that the person did have negative intentions against you and meant it exactly as you feared, but it's not necessary. It's possible there's a misunderstanding, and one of the best ways to realize there's a misunderstanding is to slow down, maybe even call the person, and don't just trust what they're emailing you. There is one start advice that I was hoping to squeeze in before
Good.
We end.
Yes.
I wanted to channel Robin Williams. I'm pretty sure he's the person who said this. He says, everyone you meet is fighting a battle you know nothing about. Now, he goes on to say, therefore, you should be kind always to everyone. And I'm not as sure about that latter part. I mean, I think that's up for individuals to decide. But this first part about everyone you meet is fighting a battle you know nothing about, that may be true. And if it is, it's good to think about it. But even if it's not true, that could help reduce the biases that I've been alluding to. That could help us to not demonize the other side. We can still fight what they're doing, but we could maybe be less angry and less disgusted about it, or at least less angry and less disgusted at them as people, if we think about their context and what they might be dealing with on a daily basis.
So the start is to realize that someone else may be fighting their own battle?
Yes.
And to be kind.
If you don't already do this, mm-hmm. Start thinking about the possibility. Mm-hmm. Start thinking about the possibility that everyone you meet is fighting a battle you know nothing about.
Mm. That's an excellent way to close. I want to thank Be Bold America's engineer, John Center, and give another big thank you to our in-studio guest, Catherine Bell, and today's bold and impressive guest, Dr. Dan Stalder. Next on Be Bold America will be Bottom Up Uprising to Take Back America with Rob Call. Rob Call is the author of The Bottom Up Revolution, Mastering the Emerging World of Connectivity. Don't miss it on Sunday, February 2nd at 5 p.m. You're listening to KSQD Santa Cruz, Many Voices, One Station. Listen worldwide online at ksqd.org. Stay tuned for Reflections on Buddhism from 6 to 6:30 and an interview with Matilda Rand interviewing Barry Van Driel from Amsterdam. Thank you very much. My name is Jill Cody, and you're listening to Be Bold America. Until next time, keep, stop, start.